Trigger warning. This podcast contains descriptions of various abusive situations. Listener discretion is advised. You are listening to the Preacher Boys Podcast, a podcast shedding light on decades of mental, physical, and sexual abuse within the independent fundamental Baptist movement. The testimonies shared on this podcast are told from the personal experience and perspective of the survivors. Not all legal outcomes are known or final. Any suspect is presumed innocent until proven guilty in the court of law. Now, here is your host, Eric Skwarzynski.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the Preacher Boys Podcast. Krista, thank you so much for joining me on today's show.
Thank you for having me, Eric. I'm so happy to be here.
It has been a struggle to get this episode together. For those of you tuning in, we were supposed to record a couple days ago, and then just everything went haywire on my end, technically. And so I'm going into this with so much pressure to make this the best interview possible to make up for it. But yeah, I guess first and foremost, before we dive into the very beginning of your story, I mean, just recently, the president of the Southern Baptist Convention gave you a shout out, and I have to ask about it. He said, "I believe we'll have names on a database very soon. When we do have names on a database, that's not going to stop Krista from being unhappy with the SBC." What would make you happy with the SBC at this point?
Oh, well, if they did what they promised a couple years ago, if they did what they should have done easily 17 years ago, because they've known about this problem for so long, they need to have a system, an effective functioning system for record keeping and information sharing on credibly accused clergy sex abusers. I mean, this isn't rocket science, folks, you know? Right. They need to do that and not just talk about that.
Yeah.
And they haven't even come close. I mean, they promised a database a couple years ago. There's not, and they, to much hoopla, launched a database last year, but it was an empty shell of a database without a single name on it. So they still haven't really done anything. How do they know how I would feel if they did something since they've never done anything?
Right. Yeah. And I wanted to ask that first and foremost, because reading through your memoir, it's hundreds of pages of frustration that I feel, where you're going back decades pushing for, from the very beginning, to be heard, understood, and believed, you know, and then you take this to a macro scale where you're fighting now as an advocate for hundreds and thousands of people to be seen, heard, and believed. And again, as I was reading the book, it's just this feeling of frustration where, you know, I feel that. Like I told you when we first connected, I'm somebody that stepped into this space in a very public way 4 or 5 years ago, and your name was one of the first names to pop up. And it was both encouraging to see someone who's been doing this for so long, but likewise, it was discouraging that someone like you has been needed for so long within a denomination like this and within the clergy abuse world in general. Like, it's a really frustrating thing to see. I want to go back, though, to the very beginning of your story, though, to the launching pad for all of this. And in your book, you really early on describe a really harrowing event that happened on what you call the dark road in the book. I want to get to know Krista prior to the dark road. Like, who was Krista before any of this was on her radar?
She was a very, very, very good girl. You know, as so many of us were indoctrinated to be, you know, just trying so desperately hard to be nice and good and to give grace and to always do what was right and to love God with all my heart and soul. And that's who I was. And I talk about it now with a measure of, some measure of disdain in my voice. And yet at the time, that was my whole world. That was very, very real and sincere in everything for me. That was the fishbowl I lived in. I wanted always and only to know God's will and do God's will. That was the whole point of my existence.
Yeah. Living in that world, I'm always fascinated by that, because I know for me, the more that I talk about my background and the more I talk about the environment of this world and the more I learn about the real reason that things happen in churches the way that they do, it can be easy, like you said, to look back on our childhood with disdain, or at least large swaths of it with disdain, because we know the motives of the people around us weren't as pure as maybe ours were as children. When you look back, is there anything that you look back at still with any sort of nostalgia, or anything that you look back at and go, you know, there were these little flecks of goodness in that background? Or is it something where it's just so much a veneer, it's hard to determine what is real and what's not at this point?
I think it's more the latter, that it is very hard to look back and know what was real and genuine and what was never real and what was always some form of exploitation.
Hmm.
And of course, by and large, everything, looking back on that in the faith of my past, is so incredibly tainted and polluted that it's very hard to segregate out good pieces from that.
This kind of leads into, you know, I mentioned you talk about the dark road, which is a real turning point in your story. But what stood out to me beyond just that experience of this horrific assault is you kind of question in the book, when did this really begin? You know, like, when did he choose me? When did he start working toward this with me? And I used to ask a question on the show all the time where I would say, what's the first red flag you noticed? And I realized that was the worst question to ask ever, because by the time we notice a red flag, we've blown past 20 or 30 or 40 or 100 red flags at that point. So if you look back retroactively at young Krista, what's the first red flag you desperately wish she should have seen?
Oh, well, this will sound kind of vulgar, but, you know, what I look back and remember is how he would take a bunch of us girls home from church events. And at that point in time, this was earlier, he was driving a 66 stick shift Mustang, with bucket seats, which meant one of us always sat in the middle between the bucket seats. You know, and in those days, people didn't worry about seat belts as much, or at least we didn't. So one of us was in the middle, and he would invariably always make this kind of joke about how he was going to put his stick between our legs. And all of us just sort of giggled at that. And of course, now as an adult, I look back and it just seems kind of gross. and certainly a red flag, because I think that's one of the grooming things of trying to desensitize people to sexual innuendo and stuff. But at the time, that's not who I was. At the time, I just thought he was cool and we were all giggly girls.
It's preying on that purity, you know, in many ways. And that's something I spoke to Lindsay Williams, who was in the Shiny Happy People documentary, and she talks about Bill Gothard and his kind of actions. And one of the things that kind of a light bulb moment in that conversation was, not only did he prey on the fact that she didn't know many things, but he also preyed on the fact that he knew that whatever she did know came in some way from him. And I think about that in context of any clergy abuse, whether directly from them or whether through your parents from them or whether through your school curriculum from them, they know exactly how your brain works because they molded it from day one, which is such a harrowing, shocking thing to think about. But it was something that, again, after hundreds of conversations, it's like a new light bulb where you go, this is way more sinister than I already thought. And it already was so sinister.
I mean, in some ways, it's like a sci-fi movie, you know, as though I had some chip implanted in my brain that made me controllable.
Yeah, it's the Stepford Wives, you know. I was rewatching that with my wife like 2 years ago, and I was like, this is one of the best documentaries ever made. You know, I look at that story, and again, I don't want to take people just chronologically through the book, because I want to spring into conversation that would make a great addition to the book itself. But one last piece of that story that I think, again, repeats itself over and over again, is when this story comes out, you find out not only does the church leadership already know, but that the goal for the church is to deal with this in a way that's going to be easiest. And you question the book, easiest for whom? And again, I look over the next several decades of your career as an advocate, and we see this play out over and over again, where it's, let's make this easiest for us, the church, the institution. Let's not make it easy for the victim who's experienced abuse. Why do you think there's such a misguided approach to these cases where they look at the institution before the individual?
Because it is all about image and institutional protection. It's an industry. And that's what it's about, is branding, keeping the brand pure, keeping the brand the way they want to present it, controlling that narrative, controlling the brand. And survivor stories are aberrant stories outside what they want in that box of an image they're presenting, because that, that image, you know, what turns on that image is, of course, all the dollars flowing in and the maintenance of the institution. Power preserves itself. And so I think it's really always all been about that and still is.
Yeah. I'm excited to be able to pick your brain on these things because, again, you've spent so much time on the inner workings of this. And one of the things that's so fascinating to me is that it feels like a playbook has been passed out to everybody from the country church down the road to the mega church in the inner city to the conventions that run these churches in the Southern Baptist world. Growing up, we didn't have a formal convention in the Independent Baptist world, but there was definitely affiliations and circles that you do not violate. Like, there was a boys network, you know, that's why I call the show Preacher Boys. There's a boys network of people that protect each other. Why does it feel like there's been a playbook passed out? Do you think this is something that's actually formally learned by other leadership? Do you think it's something that just is a default by bad men who've worked their way into power? Like, where do you think this playbook really comes from?
Well, I don't think it's just about bad men. That much I kind of know for sure, or definitely think, because it's just so much bigger than bad men. If this were only about bad men, then it would be a much lesser problem. But it's not. It's about also all the good people who do nothing. It's about all the systems. It's about this playbook that just keeps perpetuating itself. And yes, that is exactly what we see again and again and again. Countless survivors have said that it's as though there's a playbook out there. And it is. You know, if you talk about this in the abstract, invariably there will be church people and maybe even very well-intentioned and well-meaning, and they may truly believe it. Who will invariably say, well, if I knew anything was happening to some kid, I'd be sure to say something. I wouldn't cover it up. Invariably, this is what people say in the abstract. But again and again and again and again, when allegations hit on the home turf in that same church, the playbook is followed.
Right.
And it is attempted to be covered up.
Well, it raises the question, you know, it's the old quote, all that's necessary for the triumph of evil is for good men to do nothing. How little can you do before you're not a good person anymore? Because there's people that I look at that I know that are rational, at least for all intents and purposes, seem to be rational, moral, good people, well-intentioned, like you said, yet they are still affiliating with these organizations or still herald these pastors as great men. And again, I've been doing this for a fraction of the amount of time that you've been doing it, and I'm already losing patience with those quote unquote good people. And I have a hard time giving them that label. So how much apathy can someone have before we start labeling them as just as bad, if not maybe worse, than some of the nefarious people at the top of these systems?
Well, I think that's exactly right, because so long as, I mean, the problem is so much bigger than just the perpetrators of these deeds, the sexual abuse. It is this vast network of enablers, of people who are complicit enablers, who actively work to cover up these things and who do nothing, who impose no consequences.
Right.
Who never make any kind of institutional amends. And without all those enablers, this system would not exist.
Right.
And yet these are the very people who view themselves as righteous and good and say, oh, we aren't like those horrible people committing sexual abuse, but they are the very people who are allowing it.
Well, and even the leadership who is directly allowing it stands in these culture war issues, for what they would call culture war issues, where they stand against grooming, you know, but they're even the words that they appropriate that are good topics that they should be covering, they're using to kind of mask other issues that are important to them. And I guess my other question, from what you've seen, do you think that it is purely a financial thing at this point, where we can't afford to lose our multi-million dollar megachurch buildings? Do you think it's something that is, because again, I look at this where I just can't understand the motivation of taking such a hard, unpopular stance on so many issues and then stopping at the one thing that should be the most bipartisan issue that all people should stand against. Like, what's the driving factor, you think, for the top? Not necessarily those who are actually doing the abuse itself, but the people who say, this is not the issue we want to, like, kind of stamp our names to, or the issues that people like a Bart Barber kind of tiptoe around.
I think it is, by and large, an issue of money, that they are protecting the institutional dollars, which is to say, in the Southern Baptist Convention, they're protecting the big dollars, the dollars that come in through the cooperative program through to the national entities of the Southern Baptist Convention and the state conventions. And well, what I find ironic about that is they aren't really even protecting the local churches.
Right.
The local churches would be far better off if they had access to information.
Yeah.
So they talk about local church autonomy, but they aren't protecting the local churches. They're protecting the big dollars.
Yeah.
And I do think it's mostly about money. I also think it's about their own self-image. They've built up these images of themselves as good and righteous people. And these are narratives that run very counter to that image. And so they will do everything to fend off those narratives that challenge their own self-identity.
Yeah. It's such a bizarre thing because, again, I've seen this play out hundreds of times. And that's the thing, is we could talk about any variety of these stories and it's a photocopy of hundreds more just like it. But I've had this conversation with people who are defensive of their own ministry. And I've said to them, if you dealt with this the right way, it would do far more for your reputation than just sweeping under the proverbial rug and saying, okay, let's not look at it. Let's not talk about it. Because the churches that do the bare minimum, one of my friends who's a survivor that I talk to a lot, she says the bar is literally in hell at this point. Like, there's such a low bar for people to do the right thing, where it's like, even if you just publicly address it and say, we don't stand for that here, you're a hero. Like, you did such great work, even though that's the bare minimum you could do. I just don't understand how still there's such a lack of understanding around, if we just deal with this publicly, it's a better PR move ultimately for us in the eyes of most people than covering it up for this, like, very select few.
You would think so. At the same time, the truth is, by and large, for a whole lot of years, this has worked for them.
Sure.
To cover it up. This didn't really blow up until about 5 years ago with the abuse of with the Southern Baptist Convention. Until about 5 years ago, even though there were many of us out there who were, you know, working with blogs and other
sure
things to try to bring it to light. But it was about 5 years ago when it really blew up. And so that's a fairly recent history. And before that, they did a pretty good job of keeping it under wraps, and that worked. And so that's what they tend to fall back on.
What was the, and as someone who is looking at the SBC from somewhat of an outside perspective. I've learned a lot more about the SBC, you know, getting into this. What was the trigger point, like the biggest trigger point 5 years ago that launches like mainstream awareness about this issue? Because obviously, like you said, there's many that have been doing this work for decades in some form through blogs or through, you know, books, sharing perspectives on this. What was the trigger point that brought this into the mainstream for the SBC specifically?
An investigative series of articles that was done jointly by the Houston Chronicle newspaper and the San Antonio Express News, which was focused strictly on the Southern Baptist Convention, mostly on child sex abuse within the Southern Baptist Convention and cover-ups. And it implicated a lot of very high-level leaders within the Southern Baptist Convention. And that got picked up by a lot of other newspapers, of course, too. And that kind of was what brought it into the consciousness of a broader public. But of course, the truth is, as far back as 17 years ago, the ABC 2020 show did an expose on this. And that simply did not kind of gain traction. It got some attention, but then it quickly faded. And I think what the SBC keeps hoping is that it will be that story all over again. Yeah, that was bad when that ABC 2020 thing came out. Yeah. But, you know, we waited, you know, 8 months, 9 months, and the media moved on, and it all faded into the background. And I think they're still hoping that that will happen again.
Shout out to Texas newspapers, because one of the big things that really blew up the Independent Baptist world was a Star Telegram report that found 400 cases of abuse within, and this is a small local paper that's finding hundreds and hundreds of these stories, did fantastic work in journalism. And what's funny is, even before that, there was a 2020 documentary about the IFB that didn't gain much traction, kind of disappeared. So it's kind of funny, the similarities in this. And
am I remembering right that was Sarah Smith?
Yes.
Yeah, it was fabulous.
Which
work.
Amazing journalism, and it still has ripple effects to this day. I'm curious now, like, I think the big piece for me that I'm seeing, because again, there's so much similarity in both of those denominations and the way it's been reported, and the fact that this is not going away at this point, it's too well known. And what a lot of these pastors are missing is that we're in a social media age. And that doesn't just mean, oh, now we have social media. It means now you have another level of people coming into this who understand the online world in a way where, you know, you mentioned at the end of your book, like the Hannah Cates of the world, who are going to be a thorn in the side on social media forever. They understand and they know how to manage that world better than the Bart Barbers of the world and all the other leadership coming into this. What are some things that make you hopeful for the next generation of advocates and for really the fact that, you know, this is something, like you said, can't go away? The internet is just a different beast than papers or television reports or, you know, quick bursts of awareness. Like, this is something that 24/7 people are now banging the drum about. What makes you most optimistic about that change?
Well, it is people like Hannah Cate, people much younger than me. And I'm just so very proud of her. And oh my gosh, she's been through so much.
Yeah.
But what a fighter she is. And what I admire about her so much is she sees right through the bullshit.
Yeah.
She brooks no bullshit from these people. And I think that is a real strong asset for her. And that makes me very hopeful. And there are many other survivors and advocates coming on like that, including yourself. And that makes me very hopeful. And you're absolutely right, of course. I mean, you started out talking about this offhand little jab that Bart Barber just felt like he had to punch me a little bit.
Yeah.
And I saw it and I kind of mostly just ignored it. But lo and behold, fairly quickly, a lot of other people picked up on it.
Sure.
Because, of course, what his statement did was it kind of mimicked and resurrected this old trope about, you know, constantly we've heard these messages, and I'm not the only one. Plenty of other survivors have, of survivors will never be satisfied. Just ignore them. They'll never be satisfied anyway. And that was what his...
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. Every single day, I'm dealing with extremely heavy topics like the ones I talk about on this show. And as much as I love hearing from others, it can be easy to neglect my own mental health. And that's why I'm so thankful for BetterHelp. You guys know I don't talk about products that I don't personally use myself. And to be honest, I was really skeptical stepping into BetterHelp for the very first time. I had never really done any formal therapy, and the idea of doing video therapy seemed really intimidating and scary. And I question whether it would actually be helpful. Well, now I'm almost a month into BetterHelp, and I have had such an amazing experience picking an incredible therapist that's understood and really fit my needs and my schedule has been an absolute game changer for me. And so I'm a really big fan of BetterHelp. And if you're thinking about starting therapy, it's a great place to give a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your ever-changing schedule. All you have to do is fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapists anytime for no additional charge. I actually switched therapists after my very first appointment, and the second person that I used became someone who I absolutely loved, and I can't imagine a better therapist for what I need. So never skip therapy day with BetterHelp. Just visit betterhelp.com/preacherboys to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/preacherboys. All right, let's get back to the show.
Remark resurrected for people. So yeah, people were all over it.
Yeah. Well, people are learning the vocabulary that gets used. And like you said, the taking no bullshit, like the bullshit meter is finely tuned at this point. And I think, I think it's something everybody has to go through. When I started the show, I was much more, I would still say I'm fairly optimistic in the way that, in the fact that change can happen. I've become cynical about certain systems allowing that change to happen. But I think, you know, when you get started, I think you start these conversations with the leadership in a way that's like, let's work together and figure this out. And then a couple of years in, you go, you've already figured this out and this is not going to change. So like, you have to stop taking it at face value. Like the conversation is always masked in lies and misdirections and postponing taking action in different ways. And I think now, like you said, the people that follow you, the people who, you know, even someone like myself who wasn't as familiar with the SBC side until about 5-6 years ago, like I'm already seeing it. You know, it's hard to maintain that facade. And you know, I guess in this point, the other thing that's really funny is that when I read that quote, all I thought was, this is someone who has disproportionately more power than you. But in that one statement by naming you, just offloaded a bunch of that power to you to say, hey, this person who has none of the financial resources, as far as I know, doesn't have the same financial resources as the SBC, doesn't have the same amount of influence as the SBC in terms of people that in a phone book and churches that you can get in front of, is putting you on equal ground as this like threat. And I thought that was really cool as an outsider going in. When you enter these conversations, is there any level at this point where you know, in your dialogue, which I know you don't have direct dialogue at this point, but when you're having indirect dialogue with some of these leaders, is there any level of, okay, I'm going to approach this assuming there's any good faith? Or is it just purely, I need to say what I'm going to say, and I already know it's going to get twisted by that end?
The days for me of giving them any benefit of the doubt are long gone. Because again and again, they have taken that benefit of the doubt and they have decimated countless lives with it. So no, they hold no trust with me, and I make no apologies for my skepticism. In fact, I would urge every survivor and advocate out there, if there's one thing I could urge for people, it really is cultivate your skepticism and do not feel guilty for it.
So a couple of years ago, like you said, there was a very big push for conversation about these topics. And I think there was false hope given to a lot of people when the SBC said, hey, we're going to take this seriously. We're going to talk about it at our convention. you know, which felt like, hey, that's a big step. We're going to talk about it. You know, that's something. And then there's these kind of figureheads that they would let in enough to look like there was change. I think of a Rachel Den Hollander. I think of, you know, Russell Moore for a minute was kind of these people that they would put in, but Rachel Den Hollander being like one of those primary figures. And there's, it seems to me in the world of advocacy and in the SBC, there's people that looked at that as, okay, Rachel Den Hollander is wasting her time. A Russell Moore is wasting his time in talking about some of this. A, you know, some people looked at those people as being used by the SBC to propagate a narrative that wasn't true. Like, what's your take on some of those people that were kind of in that flow of things, apparently seeking to bring about change? Do you think that they were just pawns to a larger scheme? Do you think there was something noble to them trying to get into this realm? Because I've seen a lot of mixed opinions on even the figures that do stay and try to stay with it, you know, fight within, so to speak. Do you have any take on that or any thoughts there?
Well, I think what I would say is I do think it comes back to what I believe is that we're still seeing is this theater piece that they're putting on of we really care about this, but it is all a theater piece. And I think you have to think about it that way. Mm. And that does mean that there are a lot of extras in the theater piece and there are a lot of props and there are a lot of pawns being moved around and set pieces being moved around. And I think we do see a lot of that, and all of this serves their own institutional image making ends. And yes, in my view, there are people who have been used, people with credibility that has derived from, for a lot of good reasons, for a lot of, yeah, who deserve this credibility for a lot of good reasons. But then they carry that into the Southern Baptist Convention, and the Southern Baptist Convention uses their credibility to enhance their own credibility. That's the way it looks to me.
It's like this kind of chew you up and spit you out cycle within that world.
Hmm. And I think it's enormously hurtful because, as you say, I mean, so many survivors really, really want to believe that this faith group that they once loved and invested their lives in will truly and really care and will want to do the right thing. And that's no fault of survivors for wanting to believe that.
No, yeah.
But so all of this trailing people out with these endless promises of we're going to do this and we're going to do that, all of that is just re-abusive in my book. I mean, far better at this point if they would just sit down and say, you know what? Here's the truth. We don't give a flip. I would appreciate that.
Yeah. Yeah. That's not what we're about. Well, we came close. I think it was you that shared this clip. There was a SBC leader who was talking about, and I'll insert the clip in the episode so people can hear it directly from the horse's mouth.
In recent days, some of the struggles that we have faced, we have gotten involved in trying to figure out how to negotiate problems with sexual abuse and how to address that and how to address that in a financially responsible way. You know, many people are unaware of this. The Southern Baptist Convention, either individual leaders or agencies or state conventions right now are involved in 42 lawsuits. It is unbelievable. And that is heavily draining financially our executive committee. We've got to figure out how to get back on track and address this. And there are other issues as well that are distracting us from the main thing. The main thing is missions, evangelism, and preaching the gospel and church planting. That's the main thing. All of these other things are distractions, and they have to be addressed. But we cannot allow our focus to get off on all of these other things and not focus on the main thing.
And I think it was you that shared that and said, well, at least he's being honest in his perspective that it is a distraction. That's what they view it as.
Exactly.
It would be refreshing in that take. I do really, just circling back to what you just said, I do really feel for people who do have that nostalgia for the faith system that they were in and who are hoping that I've been describing it lately as like the gas leak versus the explosion. I think like when something really bad happens directly in your church, or something clearly, undeniably horrible happens, and you have to leave suddenly, that is a really horrific thing. But other people are experiencing the gas leak, which will still kill you. It just takes longer and it wastes more of your time and it drags on and on and on. And I think a lot of people are experiencing this kind of gas leak form of abuse where it's like, we're going to tease you that we're changing things. We're going to tease you with this vocabulary. We're going to keep dragging this out. But ultimately in 10 years, you're going to look back and go, that was a giant waste of time. I wish I would have just come out and said it. Speaking to the faith side of things specifically, this is one of the things I talk to my wife about all the time where, you know, I always say, because people have this idea, you're bitter about the church and you found this excuse to be mad. You know, that's, I'm sure you've heard that.
Yeah.
And I always say the people that seem to be hurt the most are the people who truly loved it and the people who truly were the best people, the good people in the church. And I find myself often saying, you know, I wish that all had been real. I wish that that world that I, that cotton candy, you know, we're going to change the world. We've got this beautiful truth. I wish that had all been real, but now I have the reality it's not. And so it's like, what does spirituality even look like at this point? What does feeling that sense of, you know, awe, or what is that sense of, you know, what does that look like for me at this point? I'm curious for you. I know the institution, at this point, there is nothing the institution can do to undo everything that they've done. There's definitely some good steps they could take, but I don't see you sitting in a church pew, you know, anytime soon. Have you thought about what spirituality looks like for you at this point and what that means to you? Like even that word, spirituality?
Yeah. And I do think of myself as a spiritually oriented kind of person. I mean, I live in the mountains. You know, I can see the mountains just down the street here, out the window. And so the mountains hold presence in my consciousness all the time. And sometimes more than others, if I'm out hiking, of course. But they are always there. And I think that is kind of the source of my spirituality. And I don't try to name it or put it in a box. I don't even like the word God, you know, G-O-D. I just don't like that word. And I don't think it's necessary to have a word for it. I don't know why we feel the need to constrain whatever this feeling of sacredness and the divine and awe and wonder and sometimes presence that we feel. I don't know why we have to name it or put it in a box. And that's kind of where I'm at. If I was going to call anything God, I would say that I have a very wild God, in the sense that I encounter this in the wilderness. And so that's kind of where I am with it. But you're absolutely right. Any kind of organized, institutionalized faith, no. But I think this is so much broader and so much bigger.
I love what you said about not putting in a box, because for me, I've, for several years, like the last several years, I feel like spirituality just kind of died inside of me. And I feel like for whatever reason, the last couple months, I've really felt something, you know, like this, and whatever that is, if that's just an evolutionary protection thing that's saying like, hey, it's not all meaningless, you know, there's something over this. But I think the minute we try to define God, we limit what God could mean. And,
exactly.
And I feel the same way. Like I go on walks. That's one of the things, the silly things I always say is like going on walks kind of saved my life. Like I had a trauma therapist I talked to on an episode, and she's like, what do you like doing? And I said, I like going on walks. She's like, why don't you go on walks after you do these interviews? And so like, I do that now all the time. And it is going out, breathing fresh air, looking at the trees, like getting away from all the frameworks that we've built in civilization around everything and going back to the bare basics and just being in awe of the fact that the world exists is such a spiritual journey. And again, I don't think I could ever go back to labeling it either. On the back of that, though, I want to ask you this question about the organized religion side. It seems to me that when I talk to Independent Baptist survivors who go, there was no accountability. Everybody just kind of ran the way that they wanted to run. You know, they look to the SBC system and say, if only there was an accountable system and leadership and this. And the SBC looks out and goes, we shouldn't have all this organized, you know, boys club that runs everything. We need independence and autonomy. People are always going to go to church. I think at least for the next, you know, the studies show that's in decreasing numbers, but I think for the next century, at least, people are going to be attending church in some form. For them, do you crave a system of more pure local autonomy with less oversight from, say, a board or an organization? Or would you crave to see a healthier organization that's giving accountability to many churches? Like, do you have any perspective on that?
I think there has to be some sort of networked system of accountability, some sort of oversight, small local churches independently cannot navigate this and deal with it all on their own. I mean, I think it would be kind of as if every municipality in the country were going to try to address terrorism on their own. And they can't. They just can't. It requires a networked system of information sharing. And so I absolutely think that's necessary. And it doesn't mean that the churches can't still be autonomous, because if you provide them with information, they can still make their own autonomous decisions about what they do with that information. I find that there are people in the IFB movement who look to the SBC and think, well, if only we had this denomination that, you know, we could do better. Because I have heard Southern Baptist leaders, and I'm thinking it was Al Mohler, actually, you know, make criticism of when he saw, it may have been when that Sarah Smith piece came out, the Fort Worth Star-Telegram, his big criticism was, well, these people aren't like us because they don't have the oversight of a denominational
body. That's every Al Mohler article and broadcast. If only everyone was like me, it would all be good.
And I thought then, well, Al, where is that oversight in the SBC, you know?
Right. Well, I know we've got a few minutes left here. I want to ask you this, and this is something I love asking authors, because writing a book is a arduous task, as you know, and there's a lot of time, effort, and reliving of things that are, you know, in the case of this book, very heavy things. Like, to put yourself back in the shoes of a young Krista and relive your journey piece by piece, that's a lot to deal with. And that's a lot to bear that on the page for not just yourself, but for potentially thousands, hundreds of thousands of people to read at some point. When you're sitting down to write a book like Baptist Land, every time you sat down to write, what was the overarching goal of putting pen to paper that carried you through that process? Because the reward has to be worth the kind of journey, the painful journey through the book. What was the overarching thing that said, I need to write this book for this purpose? Everyone that picks up the book, I hope they walk away with this one thing at least, and I did my job.
The thing that always kept me going were the stories of other survivors that just always are echoing in my head, because I've heard so many of them. And I can't tell all those stories. But what I can do is tell my own and hope that in that other survivors will resonate with other survivors, and they will see something that leads them to feel that they are less alone, something that gives them hope that they too can move forward and build a better life. That is always what has largely motivated me. You know, and I told a lot in the book about my family And people have asked me why I did that. And part of that is because in hearing so many other survivor stories, I have so often heard these stories of familial estrangement mm-hmm. when survivors begin speaking out.
Yeah.
And I think that that is an aspect in this whole dynamic that seldom gets talked about
right.
precisely because it is so extremely painful. And so I felt that was important to talk about.
Yeah, it is something that people don't talk about. And I think, you know, I guess pushing onto that a little bit more, I think one of the things that prevents people from speaking out is the fear of that, because they know my dad's not going to talk to me. If I affect the church, it's not going to happen. My mom is going to say, oh, I should have just kept quiet and gone and married this person, you know, down the road. And, you know, it's one of the things I think is beautiful. And again, it's, I mentioned already, but in the back of the book, you've got a list of acknowledgments to so many different people. And, you know, it starts my wheels turning of like, who would I put in that list? And if I wrote a book, who would be in that group? And I think what's really beautiful about it is, you know, I'm sure some of those people you've never met personally. I'm sure some of those people you've never gotten to talk to face to face. It's people you've observed or people you've been encouraged by. What's really beautiful, I think, about this time of sharing these stories is that we find new families and new connections and people that relate to these things on a deeply, for lack of a better word, spiritual level. And it's incredible. I mean, it's incredible to me just how many people I know in different states now where it's like, if I ever visit this state, I know this person who I've interviewed or who we've talked via a Facebook group or a Twitter thread that I know has my back in this very odd way, you know? And it's again, it's not an environment you wish had to exist, but it does. And I think your book, you could walk away. There's an ending to this book where you walk away and go, well, this is very depressing that nothing's changed. You could look at it that way. But I looked at it and said, so much has changed in these little ways. There's been these big shifts. And reading through those names, again, of people that I really respect and admire that are carrying the torch onward and making more and more change and building new communities rooted in healthiness and kindness and love for each other. It's a really beautiful, beautiful thing. So that's what I took away reading it.
I'm so glad that that was your takeaway. Yeah.
Yeah. And like I said, I think it's good to have both of those. I think it's good to read it and go, this makes me mad, because people should be mad reading it. But I think also, I hope it encourages people that have never shared their story to go, okay, well, there's something past this. There's something past the big bad SBC, the jerk next to me in the pew here. Like, there's something beyond this that's really beautiful and special. And that really excites me. I'll ask you this as the kind of last question here. Who are maybe two or three people that you look at as, you know, new family now, as people that you feel a real closeness to, people that inspire you, you know, every day? Like, what are some people that kind of like fuel you up on those days where you're like, this is just really hard, you know, hard work to keep doing this? These people really inspire me to keep going.
Well, there is always David Clossy. Oh my gosh, people think I'm old and have been around a long time.
Sorry, David.
But David was doing this stuff before me, and he is such an enormous source of wisdom. And again, you know, always for years, you know, when I'm just like, man, what's going on here? I can pick up the phone, I can call David Clossy and say, whoa, David, what's going on? He sees right through every bit of bullshit. He has seen it all. So I'm enormously grateful to him. Hannah Kate, oh my gosh, she inspires me. She is who I think, you know, one of many people, but she is kind of the figurehead in my mind of carrying this torch forward. And I'm so very enormously grateful for her. So those are two people that immediately come to mind. And Sarah Stancorb. Wow, look at that book she did, Disobedient Women, just about the Southern Baptist Convention, but white evangelicalism at large and these patterns that we see of authoritarianism and abuse. Such enormously powerful work.
Yeah, yeah. I love Sarah. We did a panel together for something, and I was like, well, I have to read the book because I don't want to be on a panel and not have the book to reference. I read through it and was like, this is incredible. And then hearing her on the panel itself and on different podcasts and things, and then getting to speak to her directly, the level of responsibility she brings into her journalism, while also the responsibility she carries to the survivors who give their story to her to curate and share. I've learned so much from, and she's again, somebody who is like, I look at her, I'm like, she should have like 100 times the audience that like most people have in this space. And I really, I see it growing, and I hope that she continues to keep doing this, because her reporting is absolutely incredible. Well, as somebody that inspires me and somebody that has encouraged me from afar, just following your work, I really encourage anybody listening to grab a copy of Baptist Land. It's a must read. It's a fantastic book. And for anybody, even if you go, hey, I'm part of another religious denomination, like there's so much that resonates here. 90% of the book is going to hit you, you know, with extreme relatability. Is there anywhere else you want people to connect with you? Anywhere else that would be a good way for people to follow you? Or is it just call to action? Go grab a copy of the book wherever you can find it.
Well, I'm most active on Twitter, ChrisBrown777. And that's kind of where people connect with me, I think, the most. And I also have a Substack newsletter, which is ChrisBrown.substack.com.
Awesome. Awesome.
So thanks.
Yeah, I'll link to all that in the show notes. Thank you so much for doing this. Thanks for being willing to reschedule with our tech issues on the last one. I really appreciate it, and I hope it's not the last time we talk.
Oh, me too, Eric. It was great. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Preacher Boys podcast. If you appreciated the content on the show, please leave a review on iTunes, and don't forget to connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter with the handle @PreacherBoysDoc.